Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to Podnuts Daily, episode number 417, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I'm your host, Jeff Halish. I'm joined today by Paul Nelson from SWFLMITS.com. That stands for Southwest Florida Managed IT Services. How you doing, Paul?
That is correct. I'm doing well, Jeff. How are you today?
I am doing excellent. So you talked about coming on the show, and we've been talking about this for a couple weeks. Sounds like you've got a lot of interesting stories to tell about different things that you're doing in your business and the things that you've been working on lately. So I'll give you the floor, and you go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think we had discussed maybe compiling a show about, you know, kind of the differences, you know, from a business standpoint between the break fix kind of residential world and, you know, different plane on the managed service end where you're dealing with commercial businesses and kind of monthly fees and stuff like that. So, you know, because it sees a lot of times in the episodes, there's a good fair mix, you know, Podnuts Pro kind of, you know, isn't around anymore. So sometimes people like me are kind of listening and feel like we're kind of lacking in that end, you know.
Right.
A lot of the Podnuts is more geared towards, you know, residential and, you know, businesses that are, you know, in that arena.
You know, it's funny you say that because actually probably 70% of the guests that come on actually do a lot more managed services than they actually do residential work. So it's interesting that you say that. It'll be something that we'll have to keep aware of and have people bring, you know, certain things up.
Yeah.
When it comes to that kind of stuff.
Because I miss that was my first kind of dive into Podnuts was just stumbling upon Podnuts Pro. I don't know why, you know, I picked that out of the list, or maybe that was the first one that came up that I started listening to. And then, you know, of course Matt Rainey got, you know, kept me on the hook and you know, we really miss Matt and kind of wish he'd come back for a guest appearance at least. I know he's came, you know, a couple times last year, but.
Oh, yeah, he'll be back. We just did an episode with him last night, and actually he'll be on the call-in show here coming up shortly.
I can't wait. We really do miss the Matt Rainey.
So anyway, so going back to what you were talking about as far as the business concept, which obviously being a managed IT services, that's mostly what you guys do over there. What types of things are you guys running into right now, or what are you working on?
Well, you know, we just finished kind of doing a thorough examination and look into a business that was nearby just to kind of see if maybe we wanted to acquire, you know, or do some, you know, maybe pick up their storefront. And, you know, coming from, you know, managed service provider and where, you know, we've, you know, been out there for a year now. We don't have any type of even thought process towards the residential world just because that's, you know, was a choice that we made in our business and kind of wanted to narrow our focus a little bit more in the market. So, you know, when we kind of picked up the examination of this other business, you know, a lot of the prospective income that we would have been looking at, you know, to survive and be able to make that a, you know, a fruitful, you know, investment would have came from the residential side. And, you know, everything has its ups and downs and, you know, benefits and costs and everything. But, it was kind of a interesting period. I think it was about a month or so that we kind of were getting, you know, going through the motions and going through negotiations and kind of I brought in kind of the business analysis end of it where, you know, I kind of had to figure out our, you know, the costs and, you know, where the break-even point would have been for acquiring that company. And because of the residential nature, we would have essentially had to keep the brick and mortar shop just because of the past history of the business and some of the clients that just kind of knew that that was the location, you know, where they bring their computer when it doesn't work. So, you know, it's a lot different than what we're used to. We have an office, but it's mainly as a, you know, kind of a base of operations for us. We don't really have any clients that come here. Most of, you know, 99% of our work is done on site.
It, you know, I was just going to ask that too, is it, because I even hear, you know, even talking to Matt Rainey, he was saying that, you know, he'll bring stuff back to the shop and there's techs mm-hmm. and stuff to work on that stuff. But I'm always curious to know what people are doing that are working in businesses.
Yeah.
If you can,
like,
just
we have a full bench here, you know,
okay.
I got a full, you know, a workbench here. I, you know, we can build 6 or 7 computers at a time, down our bench. But for the most part, if clients, you know, existing business clients of ours, and if any of their workstations or property comes in here, it's most likely came and picked up by us. Like, I'm looking at one of those Surface Pro 3s on my desk right now, you know, just kind of from a client, but she didn't drop it off. You know, it's something that, you know, I kind of picked up in the field and she wanted me to get some things done on there.
Gotcha. Okay.
These new devices, and I noticed she had told me that she wasn't really using it. We just bought, you know, kind of got into this and researched it and, you know, helped her pick this out. This is, you know, one of the new Surface Pro 3s. It was like somewhere around $1,300. For this, you know, I think it was your show. No, it might have been a different podcast. It might have been the Tech Vets show where they were outlining kind of the differences between laptops and hybrids and, you know, the tablet hybrids like the Surface.
Yeah, Mike Smith actually has a Surface Pro 3 and he loves it.
Yeah, and the other guy I was talking about, he had a Sony like Ultra 13 Touch or
right,
something.
Right.
I'm more on his side. I have a ZenBook I just recently got. You know, it's pretty much the same as he was describing. It's got a, you know, its RAM is built into the motherboard and it's got a, you know, one of those M.2 SATA hard drives and you know, but she had mentioned that she wasn't really using her Surface and said that it was because she mentioned that it would not power on. You know, so I had her demonstrate and bring it out and, you know, just coming from, you know, our side, troubleshooting side of the world, I just started kind of, hitting all the F2 keys, trying to see if I could bring up the BIOS, because this Surface Pro 2 the Surface Pro 3 is actually just a Windows 8 laptop, you know?
Right, right.
It's just kind of built in the form factor of a tablet and, I don't know what it was, but it eventually brought in the Windows 8 logon screen, and I think it just had some firmware updates it wanted. So,
well, that was a pretty easy fix then.
Yeah, well, apart from that, there was some other issues because I asked her. She said she, you know, was looking into maybe having to return it or that it wasn't really working out for her needs, and you know, she was going to look into maybe getting something more like a laptop. So I had my ZenBook there at the appointment and I kind of, you know, we sat down after I got it on and asked her why. And I guess it turns out with these new devices now, they have such, you know, a high resolution display on these. It, you know, if like a full 1080p on a 13-inch screen.
Right.
So like even with my 28-year-old eyes, I have to put the display, you know, the DPI up to 125% display percentage for me to really even operate it comfortably.
You know, that's interesting because, you know, you look at a lot of these devices and, you know, I'm thinking about my phone. I just got an LG G3 and it's the 1440, I think it is. And the you know, super high resolution, but however they designed this one, I absolutely don't have a problem looking at the icons and reading things. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a 5.5-inch screen. So it's amazing to me that a lot of these laptops, it seems like they're not formatting them right in order, because you can have high resolution. You just have to adjust where the icons
right.
are a certain and, size and inside the software.
And I was just kind of left a little dumbfounded today because, I mean, I don't use my laptop a whole lot. I have a desktop at home and a desktop at work, and I remote in from my phone far more than I do my laptop just because it's easier and I can do that while I'm driving. But I don't know why they have these huge resolutions. Like her native resolution that she was under was like something like 2548 by 14 something.
Right.
You know, this is on – probably what I'm looking at, like a 12.1 or whatever it is on the Surface Pro 3.
Right.
So the issue came in from she doesn't really do a lot on the local computer that would be the Surface. She uses it to remote into the server to use different tax applications while she's with clients. And the problem is with the remote desktop connection, it kind of reads your native, like whatever you have your local display set, and it kind of connects to, you know, whatever the host computer is that you're connecting to, and it kind of gives you a display that is kind of relative to whatever display that you're coming in from. So she would end up connecting to, you know, the server on the remote desktop connection, and basically text would be so small that, like, I couldn't even read it with my face against the glass. Like,
now, is that just regular RDP, or are you talking about a remote?
Straight up remote desktop connection. And
really?
Yep. And you weren't – I know, and this is interesting.
And there's no adjustments.
You couldn't adjust it inside of remote desktop connection. You couldn't even really – you couldn't even adjust the DPI to move it up to – and I think she had it on 200%, I think, already natively, you know, locally on the Surface Pro 3. And so after doing a little bit of research there with her, because I told her, I said, here, well, let's just pull out my ZenBook and let's connect, you know, with my ZenBook and see if it's any different, because the ZenBook has the full 1080p, you know, and I have it on 125% DPI and probably a little bit lower than its native resolution. And it just kind of left me wondering, like, with these small devices, what is it? You know, it does look really crisp and clear, you know, to have that high, you know, resolution. But other than that, I mean, these resolutions, you know, when you're talking about 2548 by 1490 or something like that, these are meant for like TVs and stuff like that.
Well, actually different purposes, because if you know anybody that does any type of Photoshop or any type of you film stuff, they absolutely use those devices, and they get so irritated
So you gotta see more on the screen.
Yeah, so you gotta have it all depends on what you're doing, what type of device you're gonna get. And unfortunately, I think a lot of devices, you're gonna go past the 1080p, and they're all pretty much gonna be the higher resolution just because they can. It's not that much more expensive to do it. But it's all gonna come down to who's writing the back end software to show, because you can change the icons and stuff, because like I said, I have the same thing on a 5.5-inch phone, and I have no problem reading it.
Well, what we figured out, first of all, there is an optional update in Windows updates that you can update to remote desktop connection 8.1.
Okay.
And that allows you to, I guess, adjust some of the DPI settings and the display settings.
Okay, good.
While in there, but what we figured out as, you know, we went from her basically saying that she would be okay, because I have another client that's looking into kind of describing a use case scenario that would match the needs of this Surface Pro 3, and I kind of was saying, well, you know, I just set one up for another client. I can probably, you know, borrow it for a day or two and bring it out here to show you, you know, because we're talking about, you know, around $1,000 investment. You know, it's always nice to have it in your hands and kind of, you know, be able to experience it before you put down that type of change.
Right. Oh yeah, absolutely.
But the you know, we went from basically having her say she wanted to sell it and get rid of it to, okay, yeah, well, I guess that works. You know, are you sure you have to take it with you today? Because the thing that we found out, I said, well, let's just try this. Let's try to, because it seemed like it was pairing the native resolution that you were remoting in with to then the output resolution that was displayed once you were in remote desktop connection. So I brought her, you know, her local resolution down to 1280 by 800 and then remoted into the server with that, you know, native local resolution. And it basically matched the, you know, the host's resolution to where it was, you know, respective to that resolution. So it was easier enough for her to read it at that point.
Now, is there any way that you could have used a third-party remote tool to basically do the same
definitely.
Thing?
Like, because we use TeamViewer Take Control through GFI, you know, for our clients, and we can adjust, you know, the screen resolution of the session, the screen resolution of the, you know, of the host that we're controlling. You know, there's plenty of more options. I was kind of like leaning towards that, but I knew that, you know, that's kind of one of those, you know, 100 ways to skin a cat thing in our industry where we got to kind of pick out what we feel like the most effective, you know, or best practice way to handle the situation. I knew that having to show her how to remote in and say, well, look, now you're going to have to, you know, use this application and have this, you know, TeamViewer ID and TeamViewer password. And, you know, it's just going to add a couple more layers of confusion in the process that don't need to be there.
Right. Okay.
But now I just took it back to my shop because I want to actually make a couple set of icons on the desktop to where she can click and it'll change it to, you know, the resolution for going to remote in. And then because she did mention that she would also like to maintain some functionality locally on the computer, you know, because she said that she would like to read the email and, you know, access the internet. But I said, you know, you can do those while in remote session, you know, if you want to just make this a complete, you know, conduit to reach the server, you know, bad metaphor there. But,
yes.
So, you know, but she was happy and I'm going to just, you know, go about, see if I can place a couple of shortcuts on her desktop that will basically kind of a shortcut for remote resolution and a shortcut for local resolution in case she wanted to surf the internet or something locally.
Okay.
No, but I have good. No idea what was wrong with the firmware or that was allowing it to, like, you know, it was basically acting like it wasn't powered on. You'd power it on and it would show the Surface logo and then it would just kind of go black. And, you know, I only had it for about 5 minutes before I started just trying to access the BIOS and then it just came on. Then it applied a firmware update. So I don't know if she was just kind of had hit the power and it just would sit there forever like that. I don't know. I'm not sure. But.
Okay. All right.
So this is kind of like one of the few, you know, times in our in the managed service world where we actually kind of come into a little bit of the more residential break fix kind of aspect of things. Because, you know, here I'm working on just one workstation, you know, owner to tech, and we're kind of helping her get more comfortable in using her technology. You know, most often it's more of us kind of doing network administration, you know, even server deployments and stuff. It's not as one-to-one personal, you know, as that.
Right. And I guess there is kind of a little bit of a separation, but the reality is when you're working on a workstation, even inside of a business, when that machine breaks for any various amount of reasons, whether it be viruses or hardware issues or anything like that, you are basically doing the same thing that you do in a break fix environment. The only difference being is that you have a network that is connected to, you may or may not have a server depending on the business. So there's a lot of similarities that cross, you know, cross between the break fix and the managed services. Now, hopefully if you've set your stuff up right, you have less problems happening, or you find out that's about correct. The problems before they happen and you can get ahead of those.
Yep. And that's one of the main differences, which was one of the core driving, you know, motivations, but you know, for me wanting to kind of like theme a show around it, because coming from the HR standpoint and, you know, conducting some interviews for techs and interns and trying to get some, you know, staff in here that can kind of do the things that we do, and realizing how tough it was, just the basically the difference and kind of the orientation and the drive and focus of techs when it comes to the two different arenas. You know, there is the break fix arena, and they know that you arrive on site, a customer has a problem, you know, you're there to resolve this issue. Now, we both know, and everybody listening knows, that there are oftentimes, you know, 10 to 100 many different ways to resolve a given problem. There's also the unified belief that there's usually one, maybe sometimes a couple, of what would be considered best practice resolution. So on the break fix side, you can show up to a house, and if as long as you get this monitor display working in the right resolution or whatever their request is, you know, you get paid and you leave, and you have no future obligation to that person. You can right. make it work, and essentially in a manner that it may break 10 minutes, an hour, maybe 10 days, maybe a month after you leave, and really they have no recourse against you, you know, and you've done your job, you've been paid. So you can develop bad habits in that sense, whereas if you kind of come straight into the managed service world, kind of like I did, you have to learn to develop practices where you fix things for good, because you know that if you fix it and it breaks, we often joke here, you know, about that happens. It's happened to me several times that I'll often go on site and apply some resolution and be back there the next day or 2 days later or something. So you learn kind of quickly to learn to fix things in a best practice manner so you don't have to drive back on site or go back for a repeat visit or keep having to fix the same issue more than once, you know.
Yeah, no, yeah, those are good points. I think even though from a standpoint of if you do even a break fix on a residential, you know, home computer, then if something happens within, you know, whatever your warranty period is, and some people it's 7 days, some people it's 15, some people 30, whatever, and you didn't fix it correctly, here's the problem, and here's why I do kind of see a difference, but my mindset has changed to more of the, you know, you have to be a good troubleshooter. And I want to fix something right the first time so that I don't have to go back again, because that's just going to waste more of my time. And I think, you know, sometimes with the, you know, managed services and stuff like that, even managed services on the residential side,
yeah,
you know, those types of things using GFI or whatever, I've got people that have been infected and they're basically running their business on a laptop. And yet I've set them up with something that's checking your computer all the time. And I hear from those people once or twice a year. That's about it. And they're golden. Their computer is just working and doing what it's supposed to do all the time. So I think even on both sides of the fence, there is true. There's less obligation from a residential standpoint, but from a personal standpoint, you know, doing the work that you can do best, I think it's one of those things where, you know, you really have to look at it almost the same on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, and this is a situation where, you know, we can applaud you and thank you for, you know, your moral devotion to the industry, but not everybody and every tech, you know, that people will run into, you know, from the many different ways that people find technicians will oftentimes not run into somebody that has the moral fortitude that you do, you know, to be able to take care of a problem or care that it gets resolved right. They mainly are there seeking a paycheck. And
there's definitely a lot of that going on. I mean, you have people that I've turned business down where somebody says, hey, can you come over and remove a virus? Well, yeah, I can. Okay, well, can you do it like, you know, bring your USB stick and have it done within an hour? Well, no, I can't.
Yeah,
because I don't know exactly.
I'll be doing a disservice to you.
Exactly. I would be doing a disservice. I don't know exactly what's going on. Chances are I'm going to have to pick it up, bring it back to my shop, fix it, and then bring it back to you once it is done properly. And yes, there's a lot of people out there. They'll charge a, you know, inexpensive rate, $50 or whatever. They'll go on site. They'll throw in their USB stick. They'll get Internet Explorer back working. Hey, you're good. Run a couple scans maybe, and they're in and out the door. They made $50, and that computer's running just as slow as it was.
Until it repropagates.
And, exactly.
But then, hey, they view that as repeat business. So,
well, but here's the reality. The people that are doing that, I watch it from year to year as I've lived in this area.
Yeah.
These people are in business for no longer than 8 months. Of course. In and out, done. And so I'm picking up those businesses. So I just sit back and go, okay. That's cool.
That's one of the main points that I had to deliver during this last kind of forte that we had into the, you know, prospective buyout. And I just kind of tried to put forth the idea that, you know, in business, you operate a business and you kind of create an entity. You say, this is going to be my business to, you know, deliver X service.
Right.
Now, you can run the business in a couple different ways. You can run the business in a manner that you're going to pursue, you know, the best service. You're going to try to apply whatever the nature of your business is to the best manner of your ability. And you're going to realize that as you do that, you know, financial rewards and, you know, the money aspect of it and the earning a living will come as a collateral and auxiliary kind of, you know, secondary benefit to pursuing, you know, the best application of the service in your industry that you can apply.
Right.
Some people don't see it that way. They see that they're going to create a business and start an entity solely to generate money. That is the reason why they're in business. They're not there necessarily to give the best service. They're not there necessarily to protect, you know, the interests of their clients and make sure that they get taken care of in, you know, a reasonable and, moral way. It's just mainly for how much money can I reap from this exploit.
You know, it is unfortunate that that happens, but that's the same reason that my business grows every year.
Yeah, and that's the same reason why we were, you know, considering a buyout,
right?
And not
right.
the other way around. So
exactly.
So yeah, I mean, other than that, you know, and I see it from the tech end. So a lot of times we'll bring in, you know, some interns or prospective employees, and they're so used to the break fix manner of things that it's kind of like to get the ticket off their desk as quickly as possible, or to get, you know, to turn over the client as quickly as possible. And, you know, they're also directly involved most of the time with billing and the financial end of it. We don't want to develop, we want, you know, an employee or a tech that is savvy, sales savvy, and they understand the financial aspect of it, but also, you know, as like a tier one tech or, you know, standard, you know, on-site tech for us, you're going to be completely detached from the financial end of it. You're not going to be involved in billing. You're not going to be involved in invoicing. You know, you're not going to really communicate with the clients about finances or billing in any way, shape, or form. You're there to provide a service and get things going until they're as happy and they have no longer need for you to be there.
Right.
So,
and that makes perfect sense. You definitely want to have that separation, because here's a problem I see in a lot of businesses is that not everybody can do everything. And there's a lot of businesses out there where everybody is trying to do everything in that business. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you need to, if you're not good at, you know, the financial end, you need to hire somebody that they can take care of that billing, invoicing, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. If you're not good at the tech end, you know, or business management end, any of these types of things, you can always hire somebody to take care of those things. Yeah. And I think that's important in today's day and age.
Yep. And there's people out there, and, you know, this is where we can applaud you and your service to the industry, because there's a great resource, you know, for people that, even if they're not there to specifically come on board for your business, that they can definitely point you in the right direction. Like Marshall Emery is a great resource to contact, a great knowledgeable business person. You know, he was in the military, in the service, and just kind of has a, you know, a direct, you know, assertive way to kind of tell you, you know, the things that you need to have in place for you to, you know, grow on a healthy pace and, you know, establish a good solid foundation, you know, to kind of stabilize the growth that you're looking for.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I love about Marshall is this is how he's often told me, and unfortunately it's backfired on him now, but he'll come to me and he'll say, I understand what you're saying, but let me tell you why you're wrong. And then he'll continue to explain to me why I'm wrong. And I'm like, yeah. You know, after he explains it, I'm like,
I've had a couple of those talks.
Yeah, that's good. Well, now that I've turned it around on him, he doesn't like it as much.
Yeah.
So you guys, okay, so you were going through a transition. You were talking about getting this shop, which was basically going to give you residential customers on top of the managed services you were doing.
Yeah, like we would have had access to, you know, as much business accounts as there would have been residential. But at the time that we kind of were there to kind of analyze things and kind of consult to just kind of, you know, do our assessment of, you know, not only the valuation, but also, you know, our opinion of whether we wanted to get into it or not.
Right.
And, you know, during that time, it observed by us that it seemed like mainly the dependency is for us to, you know, earn the type of revenue that we needed to earn to make it, you know, a worthwhile venture, would have been heavily leaning like 70% or so leaning towards the residential side of it. You know, and I feel like some of it is from past mismanagement, you know, of clients. There should be a lot more people, you know, that are on monthlies and doing this type of service like that we are doing. But, you know, it was hard coming from, you know, a year's worth of, you know, sole focus on commercial and monthly kind of recurring managed service, you know, aspect to kind of jump right into the residential. And it's, you know, in the end, we decided it just wasn't for us. I feel like that was going to open up too broad of a scope for us to, you know, try to, you know, take that on. It would have never been taken on as, you know, an acquisition as far as, you know, unifying any type of brand name or anything. It would have always kind of been, existed as two separate entities. But, you know, even just, you know, exploring into it, it was decided early on that I would, you know, if it happened, I would probably be staying back to do the managed service side of things anyways.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds like, you know, with a lot of people will pick their niche, and it sounds like you guys have picked your niche as far as you're going to do the managed services for businesses, and that's kind of where you're going to stick. And I think that's perfectly fine. I often think in my business, you know, I see a lot of people will transform from residential break fix to more managed services businesses. And I've thought about that over the years, and I've said to myself, well, if I do that, would I keep any residential? And a lot of times, you know, my first inclination is I want to help people. So yeah, I'm going to keep the residentials. And I think that's true. The thing is, I think I would raise my rates to get just the right residentials
right.
to stick around. The rest of them could go by the wayside or go to somebody else. And then I would concentrate on the business side of the service.
I kind of think, I mean, obviously, if we get down to the nuts and bolts here, I mean, it's everything, unfortunately, gets related back to finances and revenue. Now, when a lot of people are first starting out, I mean, it's not often that, you know, we were fortunate enough to have it be so, but it's not often that you have just immediate direct access to the commercial world where you have that type of legitimacy that you can just go out and start pulling, you know, commercial accounts and these big business accounts that have 30 and 40 computers and multiple servers. It's not like, you know, one day you're going to decide to open up, you know, your tech shop and just immediately go out and start grabbing accounts like that, because they want to see a foundation, you know, and there's often, you know, multiple different types of barriers to entry as far as, you know, getting into that arena, whether it be networking, professional networking groups, or just kind of like the people that you know, or, you know, even a lot of people go through LinkedIn and just kind of, you know, there's several ways that these business owners seek to, you know, to learn your legitimacy before they decide that they would even want to sit down to even hear you out or to look at your contract. So,
you know, and I was fortunate that I was actually working or helping a church out, you know, when I first got started in this business. And, you know, we were running a network with it was a Windows 2003 server, I believe. And there was 30 computers on site, you know, stuff that ran audio, video equipment. So I got a lot of that stuff. But I think in today's day and age, I think a lot of people, really, if you think about it, the same way that most people get their jobs, it's all in who you know. And,
oh, yeah.
I think a lot of these, you know, a lot of people are intimidated by businesses. And here's what I have to say is that don't think about it like you're not going into a huge arena where you maybe you have 30 workstations or whatever to work on, and you've got to figure out a network and all that kind of stuff
right.
in a VoIP system.
And, you know, it's gradual, and you have to –
exactly.
I had the same thing. I mean, I'm coming, you know, straight out into the business arena. I had fixed computers a little bit on the side here and there, you know, for residential stuff. But other than that, I was kind of thrown right into the fire. And it was intimidating, you know, at first. Like, but what you have to realize is that these are established ongoing operations. It's very rare, you know, like I think I've maybe done two or something, like to where we came in and set up the whole network from scratch and basically did a complete network deployment, and you're involved in kind of establishing the operations. Most of the time, you're coming into, you know, an isolated network that is already running well. It's already operating. These people are already conducting business, and you're mainly there to provide an insurance package that in case something goes wrong, or, you know, in the time that you're not working on those kind of, you know, disaster scenarios where if you're not actually replacing a hard drive or, you know, restoring a backup, that during that time, that lean time, that you'll be kind of focused on prevention and maintenance and monitoring and to kind of, you know, provide a atmosphere that's kind of going to, you know, negate some of those things from happening. So it's kind of scary to think like, wow, these are big intricate networks. But at the same time, I mean, there's still parts of some networks that I still haven't even touched or, you know, wouldn't be well versed on just because they don't break that often.
You must be very, very fortunate to have businesses that were actually set up correctly, because what I hear from a lot of techs is when they actually go in to take over these businesses is that they're collusion together and there's so many pieces that need to be done, and the companies, they don't want to spend any money. So they don't, and they expect you to service it. And I love what, you know, Matt Rainey says this all the time. He's like, I'm going to give you my recommendation. If you don't want to do it, that's fine. But I'm gonna charge you for it regardless. So you can do whatever you want to do. That's cool, you know. So I look at those types of things. And I was gonna say also that a lot of times, if you think about your small businesses, really you're gonna have a lot of small businesses. They're gonna have maybe three workstations, maybe not even a regular server. They've either got a workstation as a server or they have a NAS on site. And you can kind of start off with some of those and kind of get your way around how things work when they're tied together.
Yeah, I mean, I was so new that I was even completely unfamiliar with remote support. I was kind of like, kind of amazed at, like, you know, the whole remote end. And I was always like, you know, feel like, you know, well, I always want to prefer, like, to be, you know, there in person. That's the best way to be. And all now I'm like, you know, this can't be done remote. You need to get over there and get remote on it and then get back to the office.
Right.
But I was so new to the industry when I first got there, I was just kind of scared and like very avoidant of doing anything remotely because I just never had the experience to do it. But we do have a lot of small businesses, and really that's where your bread and butter is. I mean, that's the type of, you know, small to medium businesses is all that we pursue. We're not doing any enterprise or, you know, 100, 2,000 workstation networks, you know, to where that's a completely different, you know, sphere of tools and resources and network administration that is involved. Because when you're talking about 30 or more workstations, you're getting to where a lot of tasks that you would kind of just do by hand on normal networks that you're not no longer going to be going to sit down at 1,000 different workstations to map a network drive. You know, you're going to be looking at more advanced techniques and tools to kind of deploy that in an automated fashion, you know, which is a good thing to develop anyways. But small to medium businesses is definitely, you know, where a good focus comes from. And the way the niche that we've developed is to kind of, you know, thankfully, you know, my boss's time in the field, you know, is, you know, lended some, you know, experience and gained some trust from, you know, different people in the industry in our area here. Because of that, you know, we were able, the main thing is that we like to do is gain the trust of our clients, because I want them to know that when I make a recommendation or I tell them that this is something that they need to help them, that they will trust my opinion and take my word as someone who's, you know, in their business as a vendor to manage their IT in a fashion that's going to best, you know, suit their needs and prevent the things that I know are an actual danger, and not just kind of scare them up on something that is going to get them to spend the most money towards the, you know, whatever we have the biggest margins on.
Right. And you also, you're providing a service so that they're, hopefully the goal is that they're not down, or if they are, it's, you know, they can be brought back up quite, you know, quite quickly. And if you can do that properly, then, you know, unfortunately this stuff costs money. And I think it's in even as a company's best interest, even in our best interest, it's best to set it up properly so that we can have less time where we're having to actually touch the system. The system is just kind of working for itself and doing what it needs to do, so the company can be good at whatever they're good at, selling widgets or whatever.
Right. And to be honest, like in the last year that I've been at it, actual like full network outages, like, I mean, very rare, probably three or less since, you know, that we've actually had to respond on a Saturday or Sunday morning or something, you know, where an actual company was out, and not only out that they were out like they couldn't perform business, like business operations had ceased because of, you know, an IT related outage or issue, which is very rare. It's very rare that a company's actual operations will cease, you know, and grind to a halt because of some IT related issue.
Right.
And most of the time that this occurred, it was, you know, due to, you know, older, you know, soon to be, you know, at end of life, you know, software or stuff like that.
Oh, please don't say XP.
Well, not XP, but like Server 2003.
Okay, don't say that either.
Yeah, and I mean, we've definitely I went to you know, a client you know, recently that they were housing. It was you know, they were in the kind of they were a glass production company, let's just say that. And they were hinging pretty much the whole shop's operations, like their what they called their server was actually an XP workstation. And, you know, it took a little while. We installed a firewall and kind of – we actually bought our office furniture from them, was how we kind of came to know each other. And we gave them, you know, a couple free jobs as part of the, you know, deal on our furniture. You know, as part of the deal that we got, they gave us some furniture and delivery, and we gave them, you know, some money. And also we threw in, you know, their last bargaining chip was, all right, we'll throw in two free computer jobs and we'll call it a deal. And we're like, nice. All right. So they redeemed a couple of those. And then we told them, like, when we actually went out to do a full, you know, network evaluation and site survey, we said, you know, that this is at end of life, right? And that you're basically hinging the entire operations and data storage and, you know, on those two little hard drives that are inside that XP workstation, that's probably part of some botnet somewhere right now, you know. And it took them a while, but after a month or two, we ended up building them a new server and actually told them, you know, hey, you know, if you can pay us for the labor to set up, you know, local exchange on this server that you guys are buying, we can completely cut off your GoDaddy bill and make it so you don't have to pay anybody per month for email again.
There you go. Now that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. You're talking about local exchange instead of hosted exchange.
Well, they were on GoDaddy hosted exchange. Okay. So we're selling them a hardware server to replace some of these XP operations that they had going on. So we're building them, you know, something that's probably billed at closer to $4,000 or something for a complete hardware server. You know, probably a 4x2 terabyte Reds, you know, in a RAID 10 or RAID 6 or something, depending on the case. So there, it's a file server in that point. You know, the company faxes and the scans and stuff from their big, you know, Toshiba scanner or whatever is going to route to there, and it's going to be accessed through map network drives for the whole network. It's not really going to be an application server because they weren't really hosting any custom applications or anything. So, you know, we're in a day and time now with the cloud and everything where it's kind of a scary time for businesses like us because we make a lot of money on server sales, server deployments,
right,
and server configuration issues. You know, it's not a rare thing for us to go in and kind of end up with, you know, a $2,000 to $3,000 to $4,000, you know, invoice that goes out just for configuring somebody's server. Basically, you know, we got a call and they said, you know, I got this server and all it has is recycling bin. You know, is that what the server does? You know, I say no. You know, recycling bin is not the whole server. So you're going to need us to come out and finish the configuration. So obviously someone sold them a server and declined to tell them that this is going to need probably 30 to 40 hours of setup, you know, to do everything that they told you it can do.
Gotcha. So. Now what are you using, any of the server software from Microsoft?
Yeah, we mainly have been deploying O8R2.
Okay.
I know that soon, you know, it's getting a little antiquated. It's kind of like, you know, it's a more robust version of Windows 7. So, you know, people keep asking, you know, because 8 is larger than 7, you know, when is 7, you know, is it going to stop being supported soon? You know, because everybody's kind of scared after this XP EOL. And these EOLs really only come at like once every 5 years, you know.
Right.
So everybody's kind of scared on, you know, towards the end of that. And they're like, well, why would you want to move us down from 8 to 7? I mean, isn't it going to be stopped being supported soon? And, you know, we'd basically tell them, you know, I think XP was created in what, I don't know, 2000, 2002, 2003, somewhere around there.
So, I was going to say, get over it, people. It's 15 years for crying out loud. It's so over. Move on.
A good 12 years with it. So we tell them that probably, you know, Windows 7 is going to continue to be used and supported probably into 2022 or something like that, when the Windows 7 EOL would be.
I think it's 2020, if I'm
there,
if
you
I'm,
go. Yeah, I so think it's 20, I mean, we're looking at five more years of solid use, you know, and that's right now in the business world. There's not a lot of people that are running, you know, Server 2012 and Windows 8 on all their workstations. It's a lot. It's, you know, everything that we're seeing in the business field and arena is, you know, Windows 7 Pro or Ultimate on a domain environment. A lot of 08, 08 R2. You know, but I know that soon we'll have to kind of.
Now, are you using Small Business Server?
No, and I guess they don't make Small Business Server because I know anymore. I know Matt, when I came into the field, you know, basically with Podnuts Pro knowledge under my belt, you know. So I'm like bringing up these ideas. A lot of these shows I'm listening to on Podnuts Pro are like from like 2011, you know.
His actual last show was on the retirement of SBS Server. Yeah.
So I'm like bringing up this stuff to my boss, and he's like talking about, well, we're going to have to add, you know, 20 hours of labor for an exchange setup, and then, you know, another 15 to 2 grand in software costs. And I was like, well, you know, why don't we just go with SBS? It has built-in exchange, you know. Right. And I'm like, he would just have to laugh sometimes at the things, and I'd like be like bringing up some like new trick or something that I heard and learned, and it was something that, you know, was like 4 or 5 years old.
So that's when I first started. So the regular server that you used, like at this glass company, you said you used 2008 server on there?
Yeah, it was 08 R2, and then we basically would add on like Exchange 2010 SP1, and we configured Exchange there, you know, and just you'd have to purchase an SSL for their domain, and you basically configure it for external and internal use. But that way that this new server that we're building them to migrate the data that they were housing on this XP machine, it was not just technically a $3,000, you know, a file server, which a lot of times, unfortunately, I mean, that happens out here. You know, people can be sold, you know, a $5,000 piece of hardware that's essentially a file server. You know, it's essentially what a $400 NAS can do and probably do better. So to kind of not be in that type of extortion kind of situation, we said, you know, on top of this, from being able to migrate your data off of this workstation that's, you know, just a disaster waiting to happen, you know, we can also, you know, install and configure Microsoft Exchange, you know, so you can own your own Exchange server and not have to pay GoDaddy every month now, for the hosted Exchange that you have.
Now, how cost? Because my understanding, and I don't know because I haven't looked at the prices, my understanding is the regular Microsoft Exchange on-prem is more expensive over the long haul than even what the, you know, the month-to-month hosted Exchange is going for nowadays.
I'm not 100% you know, familiar with exactly. We can look it up real quick and see. Let's look
up. I'm curious.
Exchange 2010 SP1. Let's see what it comes up with under shopping. I mean, I'm seeing that's awful.
See, I'm always wondering, you know, are people, you know, and a lot of people are basing their payments on, I can pay a monthly payment versus I'm going to spend, you know, X amount up front for an exchange server. Because I get what you're saying is absolutely smart, because they can put that in, and as long as it's supported, they don't really have to do anything. They don't have to pay a monthly payment. But I'm just wondering if the math works out for them, you know, in the long run.
So let's see. I'm having a hard time coming up with some specific. Here's Microsoft Exchange Server 2010 Standard License, $689. Here's Exchange 2010 Enterprise Edition, one server would be $2,400. It says Microsoft Open License. So let's go back. I'll go back to the client folders on my shares.
I'm just wanting
to see what we build for that.
Right.
I know that mainly, you know, it's going to be a software cost on top of the labor. Most of it ends up being the labor, you know, that's involved. You're talking about, you know, 20 hours of extra setup, you know, just to configure and do the migration, basically to pull all the data from GoDaddy, you know, migrate, buy a new SSL and install a new SSL, which is basically what certifies that server as a valid mail server for external mail applications. So if you want to have that server kind of interchanging mail across the internet, you know, outside of their local network, it needs to have an SSL installed.
Right.
So,
you know, something Matt said to me, he said, if you're getting into this business nowadays, He said the latest Exchange server, the interface is horrible to set up. He said horrible. And he said to me, he goes, if you're getting in this today, he goes, you could spend the time to learn Exchange if you already know it. That's great. He goes, but I wouldn't. He goes, I would absolutely go to hosted Exchange and just.
It's scary because the pool is kind of going that way.
Right.
Where they're pulling people away from having these big hardware servers. And I know that Lisa Hendrickson and a lot of that stuff, and I do listen to some of that show and stuff, that's what it's about. You know, pulling people away from these big, clunky, expensive, kind of hard to configure and, you know, servers. But I mean, I don't see it going anywhere right now. And if we go in, we prefer, like, we just got done doing a pool company's network down here, and we redid their network to basically be the Keystone standard image of what we feel we wish all of our clients had access to. This network, the guy there is not afraid to spend money on IT. He's not afraid to spend money on a lot of things, and he just kind of gave us, I think we ended up doing $15,000 or $20,000 worth of work for him, you know, this last month or month and a half. We basically went in and we sold him. I'm going to pull up the specs from the server that we sold. It's basically about a $7,000 hardware server with Exchange 2010 on top of 08R2. And as well as, like, we went in and we replaced everything in there that had a spinning hard drive with all solid state drives. You know, like this guy, he's got a new, you know, i7-4790 with a 1 terabyte solid state drive in his workstation, you know. So okay. we replaced all anything that was spinning hard drives there to be solid state. And then we ended up using, like, I know we ended up putting in a V3 Haswell, you know, for the server. Let's see. Yeah, here's a custom built server. This the motherboard on this thing was amazing. It was crazy. It says it's an ASRock SSI CEB server motherboard, dual socket LGA 2011 revision 3, and it had a 2x700 watt redundant bronze certified power supplies. So basically, if one goes, the other one's there. That's kind of that was my first time seeing one of these things, and they're kind of big and heavy, and they're kind of, you can pull them out just like you can drive hard drive bays. And they're basically interchangeable redundant power supplies. But the board can carry two of these things, which is crazy. We only put in one, an Intel Xeon E5 2620 V3 Haswell. It's an 85 watt server processor. Then we have 4x2 terabyte, you know, WD Red and RAID 10, 2x16 gig, Crucial DDR4, 2133 ECC registered memory. You know, so that's running 08R2 and then has Exchange Server 2010 with 20 user cals installed over top of the 08R2. I guess we built 15 labor hours for the setup to migrate from SBS to 08R2.
Okay.
And, you know, the network out there runs so good right now. I want to load up all of my clients on a bus and, like, take them out there in the morning and have them just sit down like it's their network.
Right.
And just to experience, like, every computer in that office boots up in less than 8 seconds.
Right.
And they also have gigabit. You know, the whole network is gigabit. We replaced all the network cards with all gigabit network cards. You know, we did some of the Macs there in boot camp with, you know, Windows 7 Pro. And basically with the solid state drives and the gigabit interacting with that V3 Haswell and, you know, the RAID 10 on the server, like, it is just an amazing practice. And it's sad that was actually my first experience in the industry experiencing gigabit and what gigabit was like. Because I asked my boss, I think this was last time I was running over there, last time we wrapped up on the show.
Okay.
When I was the blue man and I didn't have the video.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. That's where I had to run off to, was to finish that. And basically I asked my boss, I said, do you want me to bring a hard drive cradle when I left here? And he said, no, don't worry about it. You don't need to bring a hard drive cradle. And I said, well, you said you took out all the spinning drives, you replaced it with SSDs, and you've already done the Windows install and you're getting ready to restore, you know, the backed up data. I said, well, where is the data at? He said, it's on the server. And I said, well, I mean, how are you planning to get the data back you know, after you've reinstalled Windows on the new solid state drives. And he said, over the network. I said, what? You know, are you kidding me? I said, this is going to take forever. I said, you know, are you sure you don't want me to grab this hard drive cradle? And he was like, no, man, gigabit. And I was like, okay. And I get over there and we're transferring like 2 gigs from the server to the workstation in like 90 seconds or something
right,
like that.
Right.
That's crazy. And it's sad that gigabit's been out for so long and that's the first time that I've like experiencing it.
Oh, I think it's actually, you know, absolutely essential for, you know, now for internet, not so much, but for the actual going from server to workstation, from workstation to workstation, gigabit's going to give you that much faster transfer, you know, transfer rate.
Yeah. Than, and I mean, they're using hosted QuickBooks file. And,
right.
You know, Exchange is operating over the network. I mean, it's just, you know, thankfully that they were able, you know, to take our recommendations to output the resource to where they have a network now that they're not going to have to touch or upgrade or even think about upgrading for, I mean, a while, 3 to 5 years out, you know. Basically, maybe we'll have to replace a couple solid state drives if they go, you know, if they go DOA or if they kind of crap out. And, you know, we have a NAS there that's configured. He's very, you know, paranoid about having his data, you know, on anywhere external. So there's no cloud backup involved there. Nothing that involves his data being outside of his network. So we had to kind of set up a NAS on his desk. So like, look, if the building's on fire, you need to disconnect this and run out the building with this box. You know,
if he's there.
Because he has no external data backups.
Right. If he's there. But if he's not there, it's right. It's all going up in smoke and he loses everything.
It kind of makes me wonder if I shouldn't just kind of quiet, silently at least bring one, you know, baseline Acronis image off of the network, you know, to house here or something, because he basically has no external and that's how he wants it, because he said, you know, if somebody gets their hands on my client list, you know, basically that's my business. So.
You know, it's unfortunate. It's hard to really, you know, it's hard to think about protecting yourself, and you know, you see all the things that get broken and stuff like that. But I think you definitely, even if it's just basically plugging in a hard drive, backing up your data, and carrying it with you,
right,
either to your home, to a safety deposit box, or something.
I know several businesses and people still are, they'll still burn disks and they'll bring disks off with them. You know, even nowadays they have some disks that you can burn like up to like 8 gigs or something on these disks on, you know, maybe the Blu-ray disks or somehow. I know that, you know, your standard DVD minus R is like 4.7 gigs of data to burn, but yeah, some of them they can do 8 or more.
Actually, it's 9 in, that's just dual layer disks. Yeah. You can buy those. Most of your modern disk drives will actually write dual layer.
Yeah.
You probably have them sitting around and don't even know it because nobody really does that. They're like,
I know. I mean, there's been a couple times where we run out of like SATA ports or SATA power from the power supply. And we've actually skipped putting CD-ROM drives and servers and stuff now because there's really no need. They're starting to get replaced. Like, I don't have a CD-ROM drive in the computer I'm talking to you from, and it's a big desktop.
Right.
You know, really, I mean, if I have external USB CD-ROM drives that I use when I need to, but all my Windows installs are on pen drives, and you know, everything's over the network. And as soon as I get, you know, the network card driver installed, everything's getting pulled off the server, or the, you know, the install's happening over Pixie. And really, there's no use for CD-ROM drives anymore, CDs. And that's the first thing I do when I go on site. If somebody has any type of CD that they're like feeling dependent on, like the glass company, they had some big plotting, you know, printer type of devices that they have like one disk that came from the manufacturer and that has the software and the driver on it. The first thing I do is take an image of that disk and house it on their server. You know, and gotcha. I say, basically, here's this disk. You know, now if you lose it or break it, it doesn't, your business operations doesn't hinge upon that.
Right.
You know, so I'll just image disk and put the information on the server and just keep everything over the network as much as possible.
Now, that's surprising because even with a lot of stuff, you know, whether it be, you know, residential, business or whatever, a lot of that stuff, I throw away the disk that it comes with, and you can usually get a more updated version online. Yeah, you can source it online.
But some of this stuff, these manufacturers are dealing with like custom tailored, like you know, it basically like plot you can do with CAD. You design like some type of pattern or something, and it plot. It's like big printers where they print onto like nylon sheets or some type of crazy stuff like that. And another, we just recently did a site survey at an internal medicine doctor's office, and they have these big machines that are like taking images of like people's bodies and stuff, and they have like USB interfaces where you can basically interface that X-ray machine or whatever it is, you interface that with a computer via USB, and it will, you know, through software, basically digitally download the electronic medical records and stuff like that. Because we do, you know, some HIPAA consulting and stuff like that. So we get into the whole, you know, the EFI and all like the electronic patient health information records and the type of, you know, we can go do some checklists and stuff with businesses to kind of tell them where they are if in case they were audited, and you know, basically what they need to shape up on to kind of protect themselves from, you know, being audited or, you know, in the worst case scenario.
Now, when you're doing like the HIPAA compliance and stuff like that, are you, if a company doesn't want to do the right things, what's your course?
We tell them like, look, hey, we're not the HIPAA police. We're not here to, you know, rat you out or to make you do something. We're going to work with you to get you as close as possible, you know, with the best resources that we can. You know, we understand that your resources are finite. You know, you can't just spend, you know, unlimited amounts of money to make sure just everything has to be encrypted all everywhere. You know, we understand, we're on your side. You know, I often have to make that point during the sales process when we're going to do any type of sales, you know, or network survey for any type of medical client. We say, look, we do provide HIPAA auditing. We will, you know, use our practices in the manner that will keep you compliant. No business IT company is going to guarantee you compliance because the code and the, you know, all the different codes of compliance is so intricate that you can't really guarantee anybody compliance. You know, that would be a mistake to where if you tried to put that in a contract, something where you're charging someone a fee to do an audit and, you know, fix their IT to where you can guarantee them HIPAA compliance, then you're going to definitely have some legal blowback, you know, there. So we tell them we'll get you as close to possible. That's, you know, the most rational way for, you know, we'll tell you where you're missing, you know, where you're lacking. We basically have a checklist that's kind of detailed 4-page checklist or so that kind of goes through each item, like is EFI present here, is this encrypted, you know, on this end and on that end. So we'll go through, we'll check off what they have and it's in a good manner, and what they're not, we'll go over with them, we'll tell them what it would take to get them to compliant, and if they want to follow, you know, if they want to follow up with that or devote the resources it would take to get that, then that's their decision. We're not going to press them. You know, if they're a managed service client, we're not going to like not work with them over it. We're just going to, you know, basically, you know, do the best that we can with the resources that they'll allocate to us.
You know, it's one of those things I've thought about it too. And some of the things I hear in the industry is that when it comes to HIPAA compliance or any of these types of, you know, banking compliance and all the different
PCI,
ones, like PCI SOX, and all that. My understanding is that if you touch one of their machines and somebody's information gets out, always point the finger back to the IT company.
It can be very, very touchy. Like I remember being at a doctor's office from somebody I went to school with as a kid, and her parents are both I think they're skin doctors, dermatologists, and but the both of them. And we drove kind of an hour and a half away to go do this. That was an XP EOL replacement. They, you know, knew that they were going to be out of compliance when XP EOL came out. So we replaced all their workstations and their LAN, you know, with Windows 7 workstations, and did a HIPAA compliance audit for them. And I remember like just being new to the business, I think that might have even been the first sale that I brought into the company, and just kind of like taking pictures of my boss while he was like sitting at one of the workstations doing some work. And, you know, I kind of got chewed out a little bit by like, hey, you know, can you make sure you delete that picture? I don't want to have any blowback from me, you know, basically if you're taking, you know, to make it seem like you're taking pictures of client records or something.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And that's always been my concern is so my rule of thumb at this point is, because I've even done some, you know, a little bit of work here and there for different, you know, doctor's offices and stuff. My rule of thumb is if you're not going to follow my recommendations and become compliant, then I don't want to work with you, because here's the scenario I look at is worst case is they're going to blame you and, you know, it's going to all fall back on you. Best case scenario is you're going to spend some time in court and out of work for a while, just to make sure that
– I don't think that they could directly – like the only thing that's the outcome of an actual HIPAA incident is that they're going to be audited and they're going to be fined for noncompliance as a business practice. I don't think that – it's not like the show that we did on cabling and everything where you went up in the ceiling, you ran the cabling and, you know, out of compliance – you know, manner that basically then caused a fire hazard that, you know, led to this building being burnt down. It's not, I don't think it's like that in the industry with the health and the HIPAA thing. They're going to be fined for not, you know, all you have to say is, look, you know, I recommended that, you know, they, you know, put these things in practice. That's if you even get subpoenaed or have to give a deposition or something on it, which is doubtful. The only thing that's coming is going to happen is that they're going to get fined and they're going to have to pay that as their business. And it has nothing to do with you, you know, as an IT vendor to them, you know. Now, if you were there specifically like going around every workstation removing passwords and, you know, putting infinite, you know, zero lockout timers and, you know, enabling, you know, unlimited data transfer from USB sticks and just kind of wanton disregard for patient information, then maybe. But, you know, I wouldn't do it in a manner to where you would refuse business over it.
Well, and I will say this, because people are all over the world listening to the show. Check your local area and make sure that you know what you're getting yourself into, and make sure that you look and see what types of things have happened in the past and if people have been tagged or not as far as IT companies, to make sure that you're protecting yourself as best you can, whether it be, you know, having the proper paperwork, proper contract to say, hey, here's the notification we gave them, the things they needed to do, and they were, you know, have them sign off on, they refused to do it. So here's what's protecting me type thing. And for, I honestly believe for each and every area, it's going to be different, and you're going to have different scenarios and different stories from different IT companies. Yep. So just be cautious.
Yeah. There's just one other story. You know, I know that we're getting close to time here. The story that I was talking about with the island and hotel and over Christmas break, you know, they were at, you know, 100% occupancy or close to it. And
Wow.
Yeah, so we had foreseen, you know, perhaps some issues with the wireless, you know, in the DHCP server,
right,
you know, on the wireless. So what my boss had done ahead of time, which what he thought would be sufficient, was to move the lease time down to 2 hours. To where, okay, you know, it was kind of churning out the leases, and we hadn't really had any issues up until this point with it. And then all of a sudden, kind of the metaphorical, you know what, hit the, you know what, and
right,
you know, it was just floods and floods of complaints about people not, you know, being able to do anything on this wireless. And, you know, to what I determined later is people that were just kind of sitting on what's called a PIPA, you know, the 169 IP address, and they were not receiving, you know, IP addresses from the router. And sure enough, I log on to, you know, the Barracuda X100 that we have deployed there, and, you know, which is like a $1,300 firewall and router.
Okay.
And basically, you know, the wireless is being, you know, distributed by, you know, I think it is like 19 Unify Ubiquity access points now spread across the island.
Okay.
And, you know, sure enough, DHCP server was set with only 252 leases that were, of course, all given out.
And, which is a standard as they're set up from the get-go in most
right.
routers.
So, you know, we've had to explain post incident now to the people, because there was some new management out there, some new staff that, you know, are basically maybe not directly familiar with any past contribution or sacrifice that, you know, that we've given as a company to the island. They're just kind of basing their experience solely on, you know, what they're seeing in the now, you know, which is completely understandable. And, you know, I tried to, you know, I'm drafting up some policies and procedures just to kind of lay out the line that, you know, sometimes in IT that it takes time to lay out a resolution plan to make sure that you resolve these things in a non-hurried fashion, as, you know, while still speeding up the process the best you can, because you want to ensure that you apply the best practice standards and kind of apply a resolution that will not, you know, cause some other type of conflict somewhere else. So I worked hand in hand with Barracuda, you know, over, you know, a couple of days, and eventually, because what I in my head I felt as a resolution to that, well, why don't I just open up like another kind of the same thing there that where we had, you know, on the 192, you know, 168.1 network. Why don't I just open up another network, you know, that'll then double the IP addresses. And what I learned was that you could do that, you know, maybe trying to open that up on another port or something. But the best practice way to resolve that issue was to lower the subnet mask on the same port. So instead of a Class C subnet, you know, this 255.255.255.0, which is the standard Class C subnet,
right,
and what they call SITR. It's like kind of a new way, I guess, a while before when this stuff kind of first came around, you weren't really allowed to play around with the subnets that much, that it was like Class A, Class B, or Class C. And then they came up with something called SITR, C-I-D-R, which is, I think, classless, you know, I don't even know the rest of the acronym, but, okay. You know, so basically now you can kind of play around with these subnet masks, and like Comcast standard subnet is usually like 255.255.255.252, you know,
right.
Basically you can engineer these now. And, what I was told is basically I lowered the subnet mask to, you know, 255.255.254.0. And basically what that did was enable me to put my DHCP server scope to go from 192.168.0.3 and then run it from – that's the begin range. And the end range would end on 192.168.1.254. So basically it went all the way from the .0.x all the way up to .1, you know. So it basically doubled the IP addresses from 252, I think, and went up to 508.
Nice. Okay, very
so
good.
So basically a one number reduction in the subnet mask basically doubled the amount of IP addresses that you could then allocate through the DHCP server.
That's a great tip. Yeah, I didn't even realize that's something that you could do. Very cool.
And it was a very cool resolution that was reached, because it was basically – and that's where – you know, Barracuda's tech support just comes, you know, into like the all-star category. I've never waited longer than 3 or 4 minutes to get somebody on the line. Basically, when you call in, you'll talk to an operator that doesn't know tech much. She'll say, give me a one-line statement of the problem. She'll give you a 7-digit numerical number. She'll say, please hold. I'll put you in the queue. She presses a button, and then somebody answers the phone, and they ask you for your case number. And you give them – and this has happened that way across probably at least – 20 support calls. So I'm not like speaking biased,
right,
by saying like the 2 times that I called it was this way. I've called literally probably 20 to 25 times, you know, different, maybe 5 to 10 each of those. Maybe we're on one specific, you know, resolution case. But still, like, they've always answered right away, and they've stayed on the phone with me for 4 or 5 hours before, you know, to where I've had to recharge my cell phone while I was in the call twice, you know.
Wow.
With my hands free on. And they'll stay on the phone with you until it's resolved. That's not money that you have to pay for that support package or anything. But we do pay a hefty, you know, price for their equipment.
Right.
You know, we're paying, you know, $1,300 for this firewall that we pretty much then bill at $1,300, because we can't really stretch their hardware to add any markup to it.
Right.
And, yeah, that's a
that's
lot
where
for
I told them, you know, basically that if they don't kind of get with me on some type of business to business type of end where you can help me out to where I can charge a little bit of margins on your equipment, I love your support. I love your people. I love your products. I love the performance. But, you know, we end up losing money on the deployments of your products. Like, we're going to end up maybe talking to a company more like WatchGuard, like Matt Rainey, you know, used and deployed because of the margins. You know, right. They don't, they're not offering kind of a entry to their, you know, to where they can give you merchandise at a reduced cost. So then you can kind of deploy the stuff with a profit. Because by the time we're paying $999 for an X100, you know, we're paying an extra $300 for the Energize updates for 3 years, an extra $300 for the instant replacement for 3 years. So that's $1,600, you know, cost that we then maybe bill at $1,600, you know?
Right.
And that's – there's no profit on that. And then it takes – a lot of times these are complicated devices, and it takes, you know, 2 to 5 hours or so to deploy these things.
Right.
So, you know, you're kind of operating at a loss there. And it's kind of hard enough to get a business to entertain the thought of paying, you know, $1,600 for a network firewall and router. But I mean, even at –
sometimes you get what you pay for. That's for sure. Yeah, though.
Out there at Tween Waters, I will say that, you know, with 7 servers and 50, you know, office workstations on a separated subnet, and then also running the 19 wireless access points with, you know, 300 rooms and probably 3 guests per room, with each guest having 3 devices each. You know, it operates very rarely at above 5% system load on that Barracuda X100.
Nice, very cool.
So it's pretty insane. I always tell them, like, if this is true that you're saying that this is only under 5% load, I'd like to see what puts this thing at, you know, 90% load.
Right, exactly.
I guess that's what their design is for, enterprise level type of networks.
Very cool. Well, I'll tell you what, yeah, we've covered a lot of information in this show, and you've brought a lot of good stuff, and it's just been great. I'll tell you what, if you want to tell everybody what's the best way to get in contact with you if you had a question for you or something on what you guys do.
Yeah, you can always go to the website. It's just SWFLMITS. And it just stands for SWFL is Southwest Florida, and then MITS is Managed IT Services, and it has plenty of information on there to where you can get my email address and even my cell phone number. So you can give me a call if you have any questions, or give me an email like a lot of the people in the community have done. And hopefully we can kind of put some pressure on Matt Rainey. I don't know where Lalo is, but it sure would be nice to revive the Podnuts Pro side. And, you know.
Yeah, Matt's working on some stuff right now. So we'll see what we'll see what he's gonna.
Miss Matt.
Yeah, he's gonna. We'll see what he's got going on, but yeah. So again, just to appreciate you coming out and sharing with us today, sure. And thanks.
It's always fun.
It's always a blast. You guys can also find me on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Hallish or Twitter at TechNutPC. And if you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, please email me at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com. If you want to leave a voicemail, you can call 1-888-697-0162. And I want to thank our sponsor, Instant House Call, for this episode of Podnuts Daily. Don't forget, if you guys need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for the TechNibble Computer Business Kit over at podnuts.com. If you guys could do us a favor, leave us a rating and review over on iTunes. That'll let more people know about us. And you guys can also help support the Podnuts Network the next time you're shopping in Amazon. Go to podnuts.com/Amazon. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily. My name is Jeff Hallish. I am the host of Podnuts, where Chris Carruthers and myself take live calls on the air to answer questions or to get answers from other computer repair techs every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can check it out over at podnuts.com/live. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.